Good evening. Sorry to interrupt a very interesting conversation, but welcome to Tate. My name is Gabriela Salgado, and I'm curator of public programs here. I am very proud and happy to host this event tonight, which was devised in collaboration with the Delfina Foundation and supported very generously by them. And this event is part of a larger series of events called Decolonizing Architecture, which are taking part at Tate and at Delfina Foundation. Some of you might have come last night. It was a very successful evening. We had a wonderful turn-up for the Elia Suleiman screening of The Time That Remains, also followed by a conversation. So I hope that those who came last night can see in this event a continuation of the same discussions that were built last night. The event tonight consists of presentations by Decolonizing Architecture and by other speakers, and then at the end, a panel discussion, which will be followed by Q&A, so please wait for that to ask your questions. The main subject of this event is to look at how buildings that are used and built under colonial rule are informed by the ideologies and power relations used in their construction. In Bethlehem, Algiers, Johannesburg, or Berlin, decolonizing the architecture of a liberated landscape is a condition for the renegotiation of collective identities based on new geopolitical terms. How can the architecture of domination be reused, recycled, or re-inhabited by those it dominated? What are the processes involved in planning and implementing the decolonization of a site? The speakers will be introduced by Aaron Cesar, who is standing by me, director of Delfina Foundation. And just to say a few words about Delfina Foundation, it's an organization that facilitates artistic exchange between the UK and the Middle East and North Africa. It does that through a residency program that develops opportunities for artists and cultural practitioners to further the practice and philosophy of their work, as well as a public program that explores the link between visual culture and civic society through exhibitions, talks, and new commissions. The foundation was founded by Delfina Entrecanales in 2007, and it follows up on Delfina Studios, which most of you who live in London might know because it nurtured the development of 400 international artists over its 20 years of existence, including more than a dozen Turner Prize nominees. Delfina Foundation aims to develop the next generation of artists, and in her founder's inspirational words, invests in artists rather than in art objects, which is a really nice way to put it in words. I just want to say a couple of practical things. You've been handed out some evaluations, some of you, some evaluation forms that will be very useful to us if you can fill them up, and we are very thankful for that. And also all of you have very nice cards that are cutouts of posters, and those cards will serve for you to put three words in them that describe your experience tonight. It will really help us know how you experienced this event. So without further ado, I will introduce Aaron Cesar, director of Delfina Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabriela, particularly for all of your support in this event, as well as the rest of the Tate team, Sandra and the technicians, and also to the team at Delfina Foundation, including Eva, Claudia, and Delfina herself. As Gabriela mentioned, not only has Delfina Foundation been hosting artists from the Middle East and North Africa in London, but we have also been working with leading organizations in the Middle East, creating opportunities and residencies for UK-based artists in places like Lebanon, Syria, Iraqi Kurdistan, and now Palestine with Decolonizing Architecture. By way of introduction, Decolonizing Architecture is a collaboration between Alessandro Petty, Sandy Hilal, and E.L. Weissman. The project aims to open up an arena of speculation about the future of Palestine and to encourage imaginative and practical planning about areas that will be or already have been liberated from Israeli control. Their studio in Bethlehem, with a constant influx of international thinkers overlooking the village of Bet Sahur, as well as neighboring Israeli settlements, explores ways in which the architecture of domination could be reappropriated and reused when unplugged from the politics that have charged it. Tonight's panel discussion is part of a larger program by Delfina Foundation and Decolonizing Architecture, and it includes residencies for UK-based artists and architects in Bethlehem, and events such as last night's screening of Ilyas Suleiman's film. And on Thursday, we have a roundtable discussion at Delfina Foundation with Lorenzo Pisani, who is our first joint researcher in residence at Decolonizing Architecture. This week, we're also launching an open call for applications for artists and architects for our next round of residencies in Palestine with Decolonizing Architecture. And more information can be found on our website. Just before I hand over to the first presentation of Decolonizing Architecture, I'd like to introduce you to the moderator of tonight's event and to provide some background on him. It's Shuman Bashar, who's a writer and editor, whose books relating to the Middle East include With and Without by Badoon and Cities from Zero. He is working with E.L. Weissman and the artist Jane and Louise Wilson on a future film project and is writing a novel set in Dubai entitled World, World, World. So without further ado, I'd like to hand over to Alessandro Petti, who will present on behalf of Decolonizing Architecture. And later in tonight's event, Sandy and Eyal will join him on stage as part of the panel discussion. After Alessandro's presentation, Shuman will facilitate the rest of the event and introduce you to the remaining participants. Thank you.
So first of all, thank you for being here. Also, we are very happy to be here tonight to have this opportunity to discuss with you our project. And of course, I would like to thank the Tate for this opportunity, and especially the Delfina Foundation and Aaron and Eva that worked on to make this possible. The work that I'm trying to present tonight is not just the work of the three of us, me, Sandy, and Eyal, but it's a collective work that involves artists, architects, scholars, and this mix between a studio and residency. Actually, when we started in 2007, we didn't know really, we didn't think about a project like this one. It was a different nature, but fortunately, in a way, developed in a very interesting way. In this sense, we are very happy to have, in this case, also Delfina as a partnership for the future, for the residency. So I was thinking about how it's possible to present 3 years of work with different projects. And one idea is trying, first of all, as an introduction to clarify a little bit why we are using this term of decolonization. And especially another important word that we are still working on, so it's not completely clear also for us, it's in progress in a way, that in a way, looking at decolonization as a form of profanation. So, in 2007, after a decade of engaging in spatial research and theory and taking the conflict over Palestine as our main case study, we have decided to shift the mode of our engagement and establish an architectural practice based around the studio residency in Bethlehem. So our aim was to extend the analytical reach of our investigation and to engage with the spatial realities of the conflict in a propositional manner. Decolonizing architecture is dealing with a complex set of architectural problems centered around one of the most difficult dilemmas of political practice: how to act propositionally and critically with an environment in which the political power is so dramatically distorted in favor of the colonizer. Is intervention at all possible in this condition? How could special intervention be effective without becoming complicit with the colonial regime? How to found an autonomy of practice that is still effective in the world? As a response to this problem, we suggest revisiting the term of decolonization in order to maintain the distance from the current political terms as solution to the Palestinian conflict and its respective borders. The one, the two, and now even the three-state solution seems equally trapped in a kind of top-down perspective, each with its own self-referential logic. Decolonization assumes a process and implies the dismantling of the existing dominant structure, conceived for the benefit of a single national ethnic group and engaging with the struggle for justice and equality. So we propose to interpret decolonization as an act of profanation. To profane, as proposed by George Agamben, does not simply mean to abolish or cancel separation, but to learn to make new uses of them. So if structuralization is the device that separates normal things from its normal use, its opposite movement is to profane. And to profane is not to secularize. So in a way, for us, it's not enough the dislocation of power, let's say from the colony, from an Israeli colony to a Palestinian gated community. And I will show later on what I mean about this. But the aim is to utilize their potential of destruction for new uses, new form of life. Secularization takes something from a sacred sphere and seems to return it to another sphere without neutralizing its power. Our aim is to neutralize this relation. Decolonization is the counter apparatus that restores the common use what the colonial order had separated and divided. The goal of decolonization is to find new uses for structures of domination. The creation of new use is only possible through deactivating an old use. As such, a state of complete decolonization is not the starting point of this project in the sense of dreaming a day after the occupation and other colonial mechanisms have been removed, but a way of thinking the possible practices of deactivation and reorientation that are folded into the term decolonization. To think them in their present. And for us, decolonization is, in a way, it's a never-ending process. So we are not dreaming a perfect world. We think that decolonization, is, in this sense, is always a possibility for transformation. And one important historical moment, of course, was Gaza in 2005. There was for the first time where the Israeli evacuated Gaza. And our project, in a way, started from this failure. There are a number of historical precedents for the use of colonial architecture. The methods used generally depends on the period, the place, and the colonizing process. In Palestine, we found there are basically three different approaches dealing with evacuated colonial structure: destruction, reoccupation, and subversion. The popular desire of destruction seeks to spatialize, articulate liberation from architecture understood as an instrument of domination and control. The impulse of destruction seeks to turn the time backwards, reverse development into a virgin nature, a tabula rasa on which a set of new beginnings could be articulated. In 2005, Israel evacuated Gaza settlements and destroyed 3,000 homes, creating not the promised tabula rasa for a new beginning, but rather a million of half tons of toxic rubble that poisoned the ground and the water aquifers. The decontamination process has been greatly impeded by the complete closure of Gaza Strip, which is the new form the Israel's occupation has taken. Another strong temptation is to reoccupy the colonial building and infrastructure and reuse them in the very same way they were used to under the colonial regime. Such repossession tended to reproduce some of the colonial power relation in space. Colonial villas were inhabited by financial elites and palaces by political ones, while the evacuated military and police installations of colony armies, as well as their prison, were often used by the governments that replaced them, recreating similar spatial hierarchies. So using Israelis' residential and military areas would similarly establish a sense of continuity rather than of rupture and change. Reusing the evacuated structure of Israeli domination the same way as the occupiers did, the settlements as Palestinian suburbs and the military bases for Palestinian security needs, would mean reproducing their inherent annihilation and violence. The settlement system of fences and surveillance technology would permit their seamless transformation into gated community for a Palestinian elite. But however, we also know that evacuated colonial architecture does not necessarily reproduce the function it was designed for. There are examples of other uses. both planned and spontaneous, that have invaded evacuated colonial architecture, subverted their programs, and liberated their potential. Even the most horrifying structures of domination can capitulate to new form of life. Believing in the potential of existing forces to shape reality, the starting point of our investigation is the most complex option of the three, the strategy of subversion, which speculate on the use of colonial architecture for purpose other than those they were designed to perform. The guiding principle is thus not to eliminate the power of the occupation-built space, but rather to reorient its destructive potential to other aims. We believe if the geography of occupation is to be liberated, its potential must be turned against itself. So tonight, I will just briefly mention two main projects. They are different because the first one is a project, both of them are around Jerusalem. The first one is in the north and is called Psagot. And the second one is a military base that in a way represented an important case for us, because it was the moment where really we could really be engaged in a real case of decolonization, because the base was evacuated in 2008. So in this case, the two projects deals with a fundamental question: how Israeli colony, the military bases, could be reused, recycled, or reoriented by Palestinians at the moment they are unplugged from the military power that charges it. This is the settlement. This is an aerial view of the settlement, and we superimpose a map that we discover, a Palestinian map of 1954, so before the occupation. And this is one of the themes of this project. In fact, it was always associated to the land ownership. This was the first point whenever we organize meetings with Palestinians. The first thing that everybody will tell us, it's always about the land ownership, was the fact that the land was always expropriated. So from this research, we discover the map that was dated 1954 that shows a kind of old land division of the land. The one that you see before with red, under this map, is the colony of Psagot with the red roof. So the Israeli colony, and we just superimpose the old Palestinian land division. So here, what we suggest is a process that we call the deparcelization of the settlements. A new zoning which completely restructures the colonial design, creating a new relationship between the houses and their parcel. The forms of this new division suggest new public uses and open possibilities and ways with which to use the houses, some of which would be cut out of the old subdivision lines, forming cuts that recall the actions of Gorton Martha Clark in a new relationship between internal and external spaces, between public and private spaces. Here are just part of this design, is part of a manual of decolonization that shows different kind of strategy that we use. And this is just one of them. And another important one is another strategy that we call the ungrounding, that is refer to the possibility of deactivating the separation devices. The surface of the suburb is marked by its various uses. It is inscribed extensively with the signs of the petit bourgeois lifestyle that maintains it: an excess of roads and parking lots, private gardens, fences, sidewalks, and tropical plants. The first 10 centimeters of the urban ground surface embody most of its operational logic and also its ideology. This surface is the primary site of our intervention. It is a logic of the surface that we seek to deactivate in order to dismantle the structure that defined the internal organization of the suburb. Under the category of ungrounding, the manual suggests a radical transformation of the first 10 centimeters of the ground. Ungrounding is achieved through dismantling the existing surface, like roads, sidewalks, private gardens. Methods for ground transformation are based on accelerating of the decay of existing surface elements. These are just a few images and simulation of this very simple operation, but it's a very fundamental operation because in a way, the problem is not the colonial architecture in itself, it's not the single house family that could be transformed, but actually is what is in between the different houses. Are all this control device that in a way prevent Palestinian for using them, I mean, for using the spaces. So this is the colony of Pesagot, and what you will see there, this informal settlements is El Bira Ramallah. So as you see, the proximity, they are very close one to another, but are completely separated. So the settlements is connected by bypass road to Jerusalem, and there is no at all connection with Palestinian urban fabric. And here you just see some of this basic operation and how just changing the form of the roads and the nature of the surface, we can in a way reinvent the way of reusing also the houses. So these are just two of the main strategies that are contained in this manual of decolonization. And the first case study, it was the first one when we started in 2007, it had more kind of utopian or abstract, in a way, approach. But then in 2008, we actually had the opportunity to be engaged with a real case of decolonization. That was the evacuation of a military base located south of Bethlehem that is called Oshgrab. After the evacuation, Palestinians entered the base and took away every element and material that could be recycled. Upon gaining control of the site, a municipal master plan designed a set of public functions, a neighborhood with a hospital and a public park. A play area for children, a restaurant, and an open garden for events have already been constructed in the slope of the hills. However, the most contagious part of the site is its summit. Since its evacuation, the summit and its buildings were at the center of various contagious confrontations between Israeli settlers with the Israeli army and the Palestinian International Organization, in which our office has been directly engaged. In May 2008, groups sought to use the empty buildings of the military bases as a nucleus for a new settlement, for a new outpost. And this is where, for example, also, in a way, our practice is not only in a way based on exhibitions or writing, but is also engaged in confrontations with what is happening on the ground. And here you see, for example, different moment where the settlers took over, and then just a day after, with actually with some of the residency that were with us, we repainted some of this graffiti. So in a way, the graffiti shows exactly this kind of battle for the hill. Working with this, on the site with the Palestinian Wildlife Society, we discover how important are Palestinian hills like Oshgrab for the bird migration. So as the first stage for the transformation of the military base, we propose to perfor the buildings of the military base by drilling holes in order to the birds using them as a nest. Maybe I will not have time to describe other projects, but and maybe I will stop here because I don't want to take too much time. But I would like just to finish with a story that still I think is important for us, because every time that in a way we showed models and images that we were producing, Palestinians were always smiling when we were looking at these projects. At the beginning, we couldn't understand why there was, what was the reason of this smile. But in a way, we also like to interpret this smile as the first moment where actually they realize in a way that first of all, it's not about decolonizing architecture, but first of all, it's decolonizing the mind. For many of them, were actually also the possibility at least to start to think that it's possible to rethink their reuse, despite the situation and despite the real condition. So in this sense, the project, the important in a way of the project is more than the really about proposition, it was more opening up this kind of possibility of transformation. Thank you. If you want, I still have it. Okay. These are just, again, few images of the projects that has also this other dimension that these drawings are now used for legal battles. So some of these models will be part of court discussions. And we are really thinking now for the next summer, trying to understand with some lawyers how instead of claiming the top of the hill for Palestinian rights to the land, actually in this case claiming the hill for the birds, for animals in a way. So I still have 10 minutes, right? I'm thinking how much I can compress this very complicated third project. Because after 2 years, we really wanted to enlarge the idea of decolonization in a way that will include, of course, spaces also inside Israel. And as you know, one of the very important and crucial, actually, aspect is the right of return of Palestinians. So, first of all, we started for a few assumptions. The first assumption was that how to think about the right of return, how to combine to a legalistic approach that is also a kind of recognized internationally by the international law, but also looking at rituals of returns. It means also looking at ways in which Palestinians in the 48, for example, or Palestinians in the camps are already practicing in a way their returns. Again, despite the fact that this right is not recognized. And the second assumption was always to think about the returns, and this is why we use forms of returns, that in a way will combine the life in exile, about 60 years of exile in the camps, and the life actually in the original village. Here there are two different pictures in a way. The first one is a village of Kfar Inan that was destroyed in 1948, and then a picture from Nahal Bared that was destroyed in 2006. So what is absent here, of course, is the population that was in a way suspended between these two sites. And both of them, actually, the camp and the village of origin, they share this kind of extraterritorial dimension. Because the first one, the village of origin, it's legally called absentee property, and the camp actually is under UN administration. So, in a way, both of them, they have a kind of different relation with and different nature as a space compared to their kind of environment. And here are just a few comparisons between the two. And the red you see, this was the original village, and this is now the houses in the, actually where, because then it was destroyed, where people from originally from Kfar Inan are now, they were settling in the Nahr el-Bared refugee camp. These are just some of, I will not really describe them, but I will just maybe to mention how in this case, and maybe this we can come back. I don't know if now Sandy would like to talk or I can do it. Okay, maybe she will. Because here, let's say the project, it's very complicated actually now to compress everything in 5 minutes, but I will try. So as I said, the assumption was that any idea of thinking about return was always to compare that this is two sites of this location, right? That one is the site of that was destroyed, the original village, and the other one is actually the camp. So for our project, we just select a probe, where our project could be imagined in a way. And one very good example of actually, in a way that we try to think about, was coming exactly from the camp. In this case, was is a refugee camp that's called the Esha, that is in Bethlehem. And the Palestinian refugee, now they, in a way, they are exercising, for the first time, they are, in a way, improving the camp without giving up, in a way, their right of return, without, in a way, undermining their possibility of return. Because this was for, of course, 60 years, and I think still is a kind of taboo. So, in a way, we'll never try to improve the condition of the camp because it means that you'll never come back. But what we actually find very interesting there was is actually a cultural center that is called Phoenix, the Phoenix, where in a way, for us, it's a way that solves this kind of paradox. That is, how actually I can improve my life in the camp without giving up the fact that I want to come back to my original village. And these are just some of these diagrams that try to imagine this first cultural nucleus. In this case, of course, the two sites were, in a way, where this first public building that can, in a way, host a lot of different kind of rituals, as I said before. It will be the first nucleus where actually, around which then Palestina would come back, with a different approach that is the one that always is looking to this main idea of thinking about returns always in terms of statistics and numbers. And in a way, we have two very solidified way of looking or imagining the return. Of course, there is the main Israeli narration that is the invasion of the barbarians. But then, strangely enough, also Palestinians, they have a kind of similar image, in a way, that is thinking that you will come back just the day after this right is recognized. So what we try to imagine, it was more looking at what we call the present practice of returns. So trying to understand that despite this main kind of narration, how to combine to these claims, actually also looking at how, in this case, refugees that are actually living inside Israel already exercise their right of return. So what are the contemporary practice around this this right? And of course, another important dimension was always that trying to imagine the right of returns will imply also thinking about cities like Amman. So what will happen in a city like Amman that where the Palestinian refugees are at the moment living there, and actually how to combine the life in the camp with the possibility of living both in camps and having the possibility in a way to come back. These are just few images from different cities that shows actually how important are camps also in Arab cities. And only we think that only thinking what kind of political space needs to be produced in the Middle East, so in this case, not only in Israel-Palestine, in order to allow the people not just to choose between a life in Beirut and a life in Palestine, but actually how it's possible to combine both of them. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you very much, Alessandra. I'm thinking, how does this evening work? The structure of it reminds me of two songs. One is Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, and the other is Jet by Wings, which is to say, I think the whole is comprised of a series of dissimilar episodes, which slowly build up to a kind of awe-inspiring finale. We're moving now to the middle section of the song, which, and as you see, as the thing builds up, the stage will become more and more populated. So the middle section, I'm very happy to introduce and welcome two responses to the presentation, but also not in that sense direct responses, but responses that come, I think, from both of our guests' backgrounds and their own practices. So if you could please welcome first Rasha Salty, the curator and the sometimes crestfallen writer, and also Abdul Malik Simon, who's a professor of sociology at Goldsmiths University here in London. And I'm going to choose one of you to go first. Is there a preference?
Would you like to go first?
Abdul Malik? Okay. So Abdul Malik will go first. And then at the end of this, if I could ask all the other 500 of us of the panel to come up on the stage. And then, we'll eventually get to the big finale. So please welcome Abdul Malik Simon. Thank you.
So the slides, the images are of Kinshasa, although what I'm about to say, although certainly uses Kinshasa as a lens on which to think about decolonizing experiences beyond Kinshasa. So it ain't just about Kinshasa. Taking the experiences of major metropolitan areas in the so-called urban south, uncertainty has become a predominant form of decision and design, where rule and resistance seem to converge. Many cities no longer have any room to grow in face of environmental hazards, traffic gridlock, or excessive density. But it is uncertain how they will manage without becoming closed cities, which is itself unrealistic. Municipal governments are convinced that it must move millions of poor people residing on riverbanks and tollways and rail lines and garbage dumps, but there is uncertainty about where to put them, as cities have already overbuilt peripheries. It is uncertain whether residents are citizens or shareholders. Uncertainties about how land will be used and its price are linked to uncertainties about what actors will get to do what and where, as future development rights are dissociated from notions of ownership or tenancy. The financial underpinnings and eventual uses of existing and planned mega developments are shifting all of the time. Even with great legislative specificity, the relations between the various tiers of municipal government are not clear. The more competencies are specified, the greater confusion there is about not only whether a specific tier has the capacity and resources to carry out its functions, but whether they have the clear authority to do so. In this context, urban life for both rich and poor, north and south, becomes increasingly a speculative exercise, a bet, a way of seeking out and hedging volatility. For example, urban infrastructure investment takes on an increasingly experimental dimension. The rationale for African investment on the part of emerging powers such as China, India, Brazil, Taiwan, South Korea, Malaysia, and Russia is not only to acquire assets in extractive and processing economies. Africa also acts as a place of intersection among complementary interests, financial modalities, and risk assumption. As an exterior in need of investment, where both risks and potential profitability are high, and where regulatory frameworks are weak, potential synergies among diverse financial streams, competencies, sectors, and network positions can be explored without long-term commitments or intensive scrutiny. Infrastructure serves as a vehicle of articulation among diverse economic actors. It brings them in a proximity of relations that may be specified by certain contractual responsibilities, investment shares, and tasks, but need not be restricted to them. They can be basically anything they want them to be. At the same time, in the lives of a large number of city dwellers, when things work, when complementarities manage to be built among provisional assemblages of people, things, and spaces, it comes primarily from the very openness of people to each other. People who recognize that in all the turbulence that some kind of ground needs to be established, some kind of platform upon which it is possible to stand, to rest, to look out from, and to be momentarily recognized, not as anything in specific, but simply as specific. Whatever endless calibrations, compensations, and conflicts that may ensue from the intersection of bodies without clear prospects or visions, it is the persistent generosity of those bodies to provide the rudiments of a solid world, still easily swept away, that is the resource in the final instant of the city. People will die needlessly in childbirth, crossing roads without light, in flooding from clogged drains, and arbitrary violence. But at the same time, it is rare that anyone will be without a place, without a way to survive for another day, a place and day that come from nowhere in particular, that is guaranteed by no one, but that is effectuated simply in the openness of someone to some others that establishes an economy of transaction and rest. In cities where wheeling and dealings is constant, there is a desire for and fascination with ways of doing things that get around negotiations, that get around policies and enforcers. The fascination with a wordless efficacy is why many residents of the swelling metropolitan regions across the South are fascinated with stories about how things are neither getting better nor worse, about how they're neither being developed nor falling apart. And in many respects, these stories are continuations of a long-term fascination with how individuals can step out of the futures expected for them and make a life that is totally unanticipated, a life for which there is no obvious preparation or eligibility. Good fortune, chance, and unknown fate have always filled the stories about what people do in life. And in these stories that can preoccupy residents in Kinshasa and elsewhere, the accumulation of unanticipated wealth is more than simply a matter of good luck, but entails particular kinds of opportunity and skill. This accumulation is attributed to the capacity of certain individuals to skillfully operate at the intersections where the bodies of others are exposed and opened up onto the larger city, those vectors of contact that bring eyes, ears, nostrils, mouth, anus, and vulva into shifting alignments with the materials of the city. Bodies take things in and put things out. Eyes and ears are pointed in certain directions among many. By zeroing in on those moments of ingestion, elimination, reception, and incorporation where the body is most destabilized and decentered from itself, these individuals gather up and redirect the energies, attentions, and inclinations of those around them. In a literal sense, they take people away from themselves, and in doing so, they enfold people, things, ideas, and opportunities into a gravitational pull of passions and resources which the individual then accumulates and uses. By intervening in those moments where bodies drink, eat, shit, fuck, piss, and spit, scenarios are scripted that make money flow in a particular direction. Now, the actual mechanics of how this intervention takes place is subject itself to constant speculation, as some of the more renowned rags-to-riches biographies are intensely scrutinized in living rooms, markets, and coffee houses across cities. Who were they in contact with? Who did they manage to bring together? Where and under what circumstances? How and through what means were they able to insert themselves in various lives? The key thing is that these are questions asked not only of the specific trajectories of accumulation for rags-to-riches individuals, but also these are the questions at least implicitly asked all of the time by urban residents to themselves and to others. These stories and questions become incentives for people to convert whatever is around them, the most mundane activities, the seemingly useless pieces of things strewn here and there into possible tools, new uses, and new means of relating to others. Wealth here is not a product of eligibility. It's not a product of striving in well-defined parameters of work or social networks. It is not a process of training or entrepreneurial acumen gained over time. Nor is it the progressive aggrandizement of territory or loyalty. Nor is it putting cruelty to work. And then finally, there are some districts on the periphery of cities that appear so wasted, so marginal, that it is difficult to grasp any basis on which they could be integrated into any city. In places like Camp Lucca in Kinshasa or Mandela in Khartoum, generational orders have fallen apart. The basic collaboration of daily survival appears diffused across an incessantly provisional gathering of loose strands, be they people or materials. And the semblance of the strongest social ties appear to incite a dangerous volatility. Here, districts are domains where supernatural forces have overflowed the categories by which they could either be domesticated or kept at bay. And as such, even the most minimal efforts of people to make things better are suspect. This don't mean that these areas are cut off from or even marginal to the larger city. Because they lack the resources to consolidate a materialized defense of position or agenda, they too become experiments with the city where anything can be worked out. These are places where the troubling convergence of actors, interests, and monies that cannot risk being seen anywhere else take their speculative chances or seal necessary deals that allow different factions to confidently act confidently in their respective spheres of influence. So from the top to the bottom, everyday life is increasingly one of speculation, where the methodologies of experiments ain't that really different in between. Thank you very much.
I just have a notebook. I don't have images to show you. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Stuart, Tate, Delfina, Aaron, Claudia, Eva. I just want to share with you two thoughts. My notes are basically from a long paper that is supposed to be published in a book, and that actually brings together decolonizing architecture with the cinema of Elias Suleiman. I hope it's not a tenuous link or an insane speculation. Okay, so I want to begin with where Alessandro kind of stopped, the smile on the faces of Palestinians when they come to encounter the various projects of decolonizing architecture. That smile is a bit of a miraculous smile for a curator or a curator working in contemporary art like me. It is a very rare occurrence that happens when you screen an auteur film or when you present contemporary art projects to people who are either the object or subject of that project, or their lives is the subject and object of that project. That smile is the same. I mean, that smile is the same miracle that I find with Elias Suleiman's films, which can cause an applause at a press screening at the Cannes Film Festival. I mean, the presses are not supposed to, they're supposed to be very, very uptight and fancy, and they're not supposed to have emotions. But at the screening of The Time That Remains, in the scene when the character ES jumps pole vaults over the wall, the press applauded, and that was an unprecedented moment. And at the same time, screening film in the camp is one of the most rewarding experiences. There are very, very few auteur films today that you can screen in Cannes and have people use extremely big words, film theorists write about that film, and that film also be completely appropriated or stimulating or cause an enthusiastic response among in a community that's really very far removed. It's that moment. I mean, this is one of the things that led me to want to write this piece, this paper, and to share these notes with you. So the two arguments or the two ideas that I want to share are, firstly, how to locate decolonizing architecture and the cinema of Ilya Suleiman in the universe of Palestinian artistic production in Palestine, about Palestine or from Palestine, and contemporary art production in general. So the link is this emancipatory power and the production of meaning, of representation, bringing into visibility what is politically unthinkable, that which dwells in the mind, in our minds, as either impossible or fantastical or folly. The idea that the settlements can become Palestine again is practically unthinkable. And suddenly, with the decolonizing architecture, as you're walking through that exhibition from one model to the next, not only does it become tangible, it makes sense. That is one of the most astounding sensations. And that somebody with a very privileged education can experience, anybody can. It's a proposal that speaks to everybody and does not assume that you have to have a PhD or speak many languages or know Jean-Luc Godard, etc., to understand it. It's the same with jumping over the wall. Anytime anyone is in Palestine staring at that goddamn wall, yes, you want to explode it, you want to humiliate it, you want to defame it, but you also want to jump over it. And to see that in a film is an amazing release. So in the chronology of Palestinian artistic practice, the first impulse has been to assert that Palestine exists. And it's not coincidental that that happens with the emergence of the PLO in the 60s. Political agency actively funds the production of identity. So until then, Palestinians living in Palestine under Israeli occupation or Jordanian, until 67, Jordanian rule in the West Bank and Egyptian rule in Gaza were referred to as the Arab inhabitants of Palestine. It was very important that Palestine should exist as a country in people's imagination, if not yet technically or on the ground. It was very important that Palestinians become Palestinians and stop being Arabs. It was very important to create a national chronology, national symbols, a landscape. And who did that? The artists. The PLO funded them, other people funded them as well, but the artists, the poets. The poets told us, Palestinians in the diaspora, Palestinians in the West Bank, and Palestinians in Gaza, they told us about olive trees, about hills, about oranges from Jaffa. Poetry was the medium that could travel easiest because it was verbal, oral. I mean, I think until Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, I mean, until the national, international broadcast news could place cameras in Palestine, we really had a very sketchy, in the diaspora, we had a very sketchy representation of visual representation of Palestine, except for paintings. I knew Palestine from posters and paintings and film before I could see Beit Jala the way it is, and Beit Sahour, etc. So there was this trend, this major motivation that Palestinians become Palestinians. And then there was another driving motivation, which was which can be called bearing witness, which can be called transmitting the injustice. Again, artists and filmmakers and poets and writers used their art to convey to the world the terrible injustice that had been done onto Palestine and the Palestinians. Actually, there is a whole chronology to this. The famous writer who was assassinated in 1972, Ghassan Kanafani, called for the elaboration of a culture of resistance, and he referred specifically to bearing witness, etc. To summarize these two trends or movements, Mahmoud Darwish, the late poet, remarked that Palestinian artists have, because there was no state, there is no state, because there are no national archives, because there's no national curriculum, because Palestinians have been dispersed for a very long time, the poets and the filmmakers and the artists have often had to be also the anthropologists and the sociologists and the historians of Palestine. It's an interesting role. In that chronology, I think decolonizing architecture and the cinema of Ilya Suleiman mark a turn. There is bearing witness, there is asserting identity, there is all of this, but there's a new thing that happens. There is precisely this representing the unimaginable. That at a moment where politically we are in the worst deadlock, suddenly an artistic project become the most potent political acts. And I think that is not just relevant for Palestine and Palestinians, it is relevant for contemporary art practice. So I am an independent, I am a curator and a writer. I came to the Church of Contemporary Art willy-nilly. And I think I've lost my faith, and it's fine. They didn't lose somebody very important. I'm a puny thinker. Or a contributor. The point is that one of the things I think about a lot is what is the production of art in today's moment, of almost complete political bankruptcy? What do we do? How do we produce meaningful art? What does it mean to bring into visibility that which is not visible? What does it mean to speak truth to power? All these missions that we have. I think that contemporary art the problem is not that it's no longer accessible physically the way it used to be in the 60s. If you talk to European film programmers who are 40 years old today, who are working in fabulous festivals, who screen experimental films and auteur films, and you know, who know about the geography of the world, like you don't need to explain to them where Indonesia is and Japan, etc., or the Middle East. These people discovered cinema in the union halls that their fathers belonged to. I don't know of a union hall today in Europe that still screens Truffaut or Godard or Fellini or whatever. But I know there is a problem of access. I know that contemporary art has become extremely elitist, but and that is something serious. But there's something more serious. The language it uses, the language that contemporary art uses is no longer, is so layered, so thickly layered, it needs so much decoding, and the decoding is strictly based on a privileged education, privileged access to travel to the world. And I feel that if I were to be asked, I often obsess about history and historicizing and living the moment historically, etc. And I am always reminded of a play by a French playwright called Molière. It's a one-act satire called Les Précieuses Ridicules. It translates to English to The Two Pretentious Women. And it's basically, he's criticizing a moment in bourgeois France when the bourgeoisie started to delight in art and the extremely precious language that became the currency for the consumption of that art. And I fear that we're living a similar moment. And I worry about the political mission of politically engaged artists. And it makes projects like decolonizing architecture and Elia Suleiman's cinema much more meaningful and much more powerful. And maybe we can start another church, the church, the democratic church of contemporary art. Thank you.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Thank you to everyone who's presented so far. I wonder if we're breaking some record here at the Tate. The number of people up on a stage. No? God damn it. Someone wants to join? Please come. If we hug at the end, we will. It's 20 to 8. We're going to go over by 10 minutes, I've been told. I'm going to start now by asking Lorenzo Badani to tell us a little bit about his experience as the first resident in Bethlehem at Decolonizing Architecture. And then we're going to, and then I have maybe a few questions for the group here. And then at around 5 to 8, I'm going to open it up to the floor. And then 8:10, you leave and move on and leave this behind. Perhaps I could start with you, Lorenzo.
Yeah.
If you could tell us about your experience in Bethlehem.
Yeah, well, I guess I'd like to contribute to this finale more than telling you exactly what I did during my residency, which will be the object of an event that will take place after tomorrow in the Delfina Foundation, maybe to talk you a little bit about the idea of making a residency in an architecture office itself, which is perhaps not such a kind of obvious idea. But I think that it's quite important to maybe speculate a little bit about that, because it implies a certain vision of architecture that is probably quite different from a sort of received or common view of what architecture can be or should be. And, you know, like normally you would expect like architects collecting data and visiting the site and perhaps not, and then sometimes meeting people involved in the project or doing all these things. But anyway, all these activities in a way are sort of like finalized to the idea of coming with a final outcome, which is usually the design of a building, or it could be a research or kind of historical research or whatever. And I guess in the way of working that I kind of shared with the colonizing architecture, maybe a building or a spatial structure could be like the starting point for a project rather than a final outcome. And so in this way, like a building becomes something more as a complex thing in the Latourian sense, perhaps, where it implicates and holds together a web of different actors and a web of different roles and power relations. And through this spatial object, maybe it's possible also to read larger like social and economic and geopolitical problems, which actually was the case in my residency, which in the end focused particularly on one building in itself. And through that building, that building was kind of speaking of, in a way, of the impossibility of dividing or like or partitioning, or in a way. So and also design could be not just, you know, again, like this final process, but more it could be the starting point of a research or like a way to generate research itself. So in this context, probably like the notions of research and practice gets a little bit blurred, and they influence each other almost in the making. And so in this way, like the notion of residency, probably it's important and interesting, because like it allows me, as many other people, to get involved in this practice, and to acquire a kind of privileged standpoint that I think the colonizing architecture occupies, in a way, in between sort of more NGO approach, which is most of the time very much influenced by the strict agenda and like solving concrete problems, and a more kind of academic approach, which is more kind of speculative. And yes, so I mean, I think, yeah, we can. I don't know if you want to respond to this or.
I'm not going to allow that.
Okay.
we're so pressed for time, and I spent too much time preparing some questions that I want to exert my authority here, and use some of these questions. But I think that maybe the issue of like residency. I mean, I'd like to talk about the relationship between what you do and pedagogy in a minute. And then in about 10 minutes, I'll open up to the floor. So if you could please get your motor neurons working, that would be great. There's a quote on your website from Frantz Fanon from 1961, where it says, to destroy the colonial world means nothing less than demolishing the colonist city, burying it deep within the earth, or banishing it from the territory, right? Which is, I think, extraordinary extraordinarily direct and unobscure and unvague kind of statement. One of the things that Ilyas Suleiman said yesterday, which I thought was very interesting, he was talking about decolonizing the subject, right? I'm wondering, I'd like to ask perhaps the three of you first, is there a sense in which what you're attempting to do is, because I think this question of, for me, the word decolonizing cannot be separated perhaps from recolonizing to some extent. So is there a sense in which, to follow that kind of thrust of Fanon, that there's a sense in which what you're provoking is a kind of recolonizing of architecture through a decolonized subject? And what role does the subject play within the work that you're, the aspirations or the goals of what you're attempting to achieve? Eyal.
There was an incredibly interesting moment where during the Gaza pullout, let's call it even evacuation, no? Because we know how that area is now controlled, where the American delegation came in and was fighting with the Israeli government about whether the houses should be demolished or should be kept. And it was Condoleezza Rice people who came there saying that, in fact, they thought that if Palestinians would live in American-style gated communities, no, that would absolutely kind of fit the American agenda of civilizing the Middle East, right? So in a sense, there is a relation that was proposed there between between architecture and the making of a political subject, which could be thought in very many different ways. So I think it's a very interesting question, and I think that and you're right. No, I mean, this is not about destruction again. No, I mean, just thinking, you know, purely on kind of on the environmental level, no, the destruction of 3,000 homes in Gaza is, you know, intoxicated or poisoned the water aquifers. What about 500,000 right? I mean, if you just speak about the West Bank, 500,000 built structures lying upstream, right, in the kind of the water cycle. And I think that the challenge, which is much more complicated, and you prefaced it, is how to actually occupy it or reoccupy it, but in a different way, right? How to actually know, and this is a sentence that is very important for us, how to know how to live in the house of your enemy, right? Which is not only an architectural solution. No? We will paint the red tiled roof green or something like that, but it's a cultural practice. And therefore, architecture could not be thought of in its very minimal sense, right, as a kind of physical intervention within a building. But as you mentioned, through architecture and its representation, open up what we call a kind of an arena of speculation, right? So the model that you build, on the one hand, it's a proposal. On the other hand, a model is something that people gather around, right? People can discuss through. Politics done through, I mean, part of the idea of the smile that we were talking about, when people see models, people smile automatically. Whatever model of whatever you want, you know, because models are like cute toys. They're like little world under control, no? And they create a certain kind of mode of engagement which is very different than, you know, a political meeting, etc. So it is through the material that the kind of social erupts and the political erupts. And I think that it is in that sense that architectural intervention, and also Lorenzo was saying that, no? I mean, the architectural proposal, it's just the beginning of the story, right? It comes to open up the social and political question and the social and political imagination.
I mean, please.
Maybe I would add only one thing to what Eyal mentioned right now. I think that even it's before reconstruction or construction or thinking of how, it's the process itself, which I believe that it's very important, because until now, if you live under colonial regime, the first thing that you are prevented of is to think about your future. This is the first thing that the occupation and the colonial regime impose on you. And the fact to propose in Palestine right now a platform where you could plan, think, imagine, is by itself something which is very important. And again, maybe we are returning to the smile and everybody explain it in his way. But I think that what we all the time say is in somehow, when we begin to speak with people, the first reaction is the settlements will not be evacuated. This is, and then it's simple. The answer is simple. But this happened in Gaza. Then it's like a step further, and you help them to begin thinking about these settlements. And from the first moment that anybody in front of you feel the right, only the right, to think how this structure might be changed into something else, is feeling a kind of right to destroy the first step of the colonial regime. And this is what I feel. And I have to admit that the first time we began to work with this project together with Eyal and Alessandro, and the first moments we were discussing how we, the three of us, were not absolutely aware of how the potential of the process itself and how it is very important to propose a process of planning, because until now, the Israelis are the ones that are planning and the Palestinians are the ones that are reacting. And I think that the platform of decolonizing architecture is proposing something to convert such an equation and to propose to the Palestinians the right of planning their own future. And this is, for me, what is really important about decolonizing architecture.
Well, I think Rasha, in a sense, alluded to it, which was that there's a certain vacuum of agency, perhaps, in which you cited perhaps artists or filmmakers or other cultural practitioners have made a claim of agency within that, in the absence of perhaps other more formal power structures making those decisions.
I mean, the symbolic production of meaning and by politically engaged artists is really great. It's fabulous, right? But in the present moment, the way structures, the way the world is structured, where art is visible and consumable, where the way the art market controls production, the way knowledge about art is disseminated, it has had practically no political power. At some point, we believed that art could transform. Let's say that maybe it was a wrong expectation of art. However, we are also now in a moment where political actions are unthinkable. And the big motto of Porto Alegre was, another world is possible. We believed it for 5 minutes or 5 years. It doesn't, right? It turns out another world is not possible. It turns out the best we can hope for is a return of the welfare state. And yet, right? And the right is also, it's not only the left that's out of ideas. The right, if the US are building a wall to protect themselves from illegal migrants in Mexico, I mean, this wall building thing, what does it mean? It means we are out of ideas. We are so out of ideas that we just want to build a wall, right? So it's a state of the world. To find projects that are either artistic or political, but basically who straddle between those worlds and emancipate the imaginary. I keep thinking the Arabs are defeated because they cannot imagine anything anymore. And it's planning, it's being able to think the unthinkable. I mean, that I don't know how else to say it.
Just to follow up on that and to pick up maybe on that, on the word process, I'm just wondering, and maybe I can bring you here, Lorenzo, what the difference is.
It's your truth.
Because if we see let's say at a level of the images that you present in your work, for some of us we could locate it within a certain history of pedagogical exercises, certainly within architecture schools, where you know, the thrust is analytical, it's discursive, there's a sense in which the drawing is used as a kind of analytical tool, also a rhetorical tool. You mentioned the word, I thought it's very interesting, where you said that in the early projects you refer to it as being perhaps utopian, and then saying from here on it becomes less utopian. And I'm wondering the thing about the utopian is that it needn't happen for the project to kind of possess kind of ontological validity in a way, right? So, but I see elements of the pedagogical and of the utopian in all of the projects that you do. But, and if I believe Rasha, and why would she lie, then it seems to me there's something else happening on top of this. And is it as simple as to say that it's the activist element that differentiates it from, let's say, these projects being pedagogical, analytical, or even utopian? Perhaps you could say something about that.
Well, I mean, yeah, you should respond, but like from my perspective, like it was really maybe all of these things together in a way, like the power of this project is that it told all these figures of the activists, as you said, the pedagogical figure and all these other things together. And it's not really that you can separate and say, like, this is done in this purpose and this is done for another purpose. It's really like, and again, maybe we come back to the idea of being in a place, no, and living there. And I think that's really important that this office, it's in mm-hmm. Beit Sahur. And I mean, like, you know, like when I was there, you are really involved in a situation. And of course and this is also probably the interesting part of being there. And then thanks to Alessandro and Sandy who live there and you know, their connections, it's also really easy to get involved of and everything is happening, which means also, you know, like going to plant olive trees because you don't want a field to be confiscated because it's not used, or going to manifestations or something like that. And I mean, I don't want to make it banal and saying, ah, yes, there is also like this kind of activist or thing, but it is very much involved in the situation, and it's, I think it's very interesting as well as it tries to detach itself from the immediacy of the situation. Again, it's not probably, well, if you go to Palestine, you meet like thousands of people of internationals working for NGOs, and again, I don't want to kind of blame or say that everything it's bad, but still, I mean, you kind of recognize a certain difference to what like the colonizing architecture is doing, in the sense that they take these kind of concrete problems and they try to kind of elaborate on them, and again, not just in a abstract manner, but as a way of practice, as a spatial practice.
I'd maybe just like to bring you here in, Abdul Malik. I mean, as someone who holds a pedagogical position, whose writings not exclusively, but to a large extent, operate within a pedagogical and academic environment, how do you see the work of decolonizing architecture in relation to, let's say, the practices of pedagogy, or indeed the history of kind of a certain, I mean, one of your books is called For the City Yet to Come, which for me is a sort of invocation of that kind of Deleuze and Guattarian notion of the community to come. So, and as you said, the thing that's often denied by the colonized is the possibility to imagine a future, right? Which, so I wonder whether you would be able to comment or say something in relation to this.
No, I mean, I think that in some sense the notion of the colonized city is like 50% an oxymoron. To a large extent, yes, you can control the city, you can specify. I mean, the whole idea of coloniality was to spatialize whose lives counted for something and whose lives could be wasted. And this certainly remains true for a lot of urban governance today. But I think that any time you attempt to control the city, any time you attempt to impose a sense of eligibility on it, who can do what, where, when, you make visible the potentials of city life to do something else. And it is this something else which doesn't try to root itself within particular kinds of programmatic pedagogical orientations that I understand the project of decolonizing architecture to be, mm-hmm. but rather to cut through those kinds of categorizations, cut through those kinds of sectoral parameters through which we interpret and frame the city. And that cutting through becomes a kind of a kind of action which in some sense has these kinds of decolonizing maneuvers.
Thank you. I'm going to open it up to the audience. Are there any?
No,
oh, sorry, Sandy,
only,
and then we'll
take. Are you hearing me?
You
yeah.
This is my turn.
Okay. No, I want to add one more thing in your question. We are all the time accused and asked by, every time we are going to do a conference or we are in the studio or wherever, we are all the time accused not to explain. And they all the time says, but you are not giving a background of what you are saying. You are beginning all the time from the middle of nowhere, you know? And this complaining is exactly the essence of the pedagogical process that we are using in our residency, because we pretend that if you want to deal with what decolonizing architecture is doing, that you have to begin from the M. We can't all the time begin from the A, because otherwise we will return back to what Resha was explaining about bearing testimony to what's happening. So you pretend that you come as a scholar and you see the wall for the first time, and I can understand your reaction seeing the wall for the first time or seeing the colony for the first time, and you think that there is a kind of tabula rasa in Palestine and you will be the first one that will be able to represent perfectly the wall. Whoever is coming to our residency is not absolutely permitted to think it this way. It's just like this is a kind of basic common ground that we have to deal with. Otherwise, you are not welcome to such residency, because really, we offer a platform where we have to begin thinking about decolonization from the end, because otherwise we will be explaining, re-explaining the same thing. So in this sense, I believe that we force a kind of platform and the kind of a way that we ourselves forced our thinking into this direction, because I remember that we, the three of us, were in Berlin like 5 years ago or what, when your book and Alessandro's book just like was issued out. We finished our PhD. We were sitting in these stairs in front of one of the museums that I didn't remember what's the name. And the three of us were depressed because we thought, okay, we finished our career here, you know? We already studied everything, explaining, publishing, and representing. What shall we do right now? How shall we go on? The conflict is going on, but we can't really all the time represent. We are bored from ourselves. How would people would not be bored of us? So this is what we are really, I think, that what we propose through decolonizing architecture is to begin from the end. And what we are offering in this sense is a kind of place where you could really come and look at the wall, see the wall, but differently. See the wall and maybe jump the wall in this sense. And this is what I feel is important when you are coming to the platform of decolonizing architecture. And if this is not your attempt, I think it's better not to come. So.
You've been warned. You've been warned. Are there any questions? We need the microphone here, please, in the middle.
Hello. A fascinating discussion so far. My name is Abe Haim, and belong to a group called Architects and Planners for Justice in Palestine. And we're challenging Israeli architects. Now, you talk about the wall, and starting from the end, you know, with the sort of colonial setup in the West Bank. Have you considered sort of going over the wall, you know, to what is happening within Israel? For instance, you did actually mention, Alessandro, about your thinking of not only, you know, the occupied territories, but what's happening around in the, you know, in Lebanon, Syria. But within Israel itself, I mean, there's an erasure going on of even cities like Jaffa and Ramle and Acre, where settlers are actually moving into Arab neighborhoods, you know, to take over the areas, you know, neighborhoods like Ajami and in Jaffa. Have you considered sort of in the field of pedagogy trying to connect with, say, first of all, the Israeli university, you know, architectural schools? I know, for instance, Tzvi Efrat at the Bezalel, you know, was a contributor to Eyal's original, you know, civilian occupation. Getting these ideas, you know, sort of thought about and you know, part of architectural training, you know, within Israeli universities, and also connecting with organizations like Zohrot, which are doing, you know, which is doing wonderful work, and also in the reconstruction of destroyed villages, like Birim, for instance, Kafr Birim in the Galilee. I think it's wonderful that you can actually expand, you know, the whole field of this. And also in the area, for instance, of working with Riwak, where they're trying to bring to life the villages, you know, within the West Bank as well, in Birzeit, things like that. And just one last point, you know, the city that's being supposedly built, Rawabi, in the West Bank near Ramallah, if you look at the plans for Rawabi, they actually look like Maale Adumim or some of the terrible, the fortress settlements, Har Homa. Now, this is the model that is actually being foisted on to Palestine. I mean, what are you going to do about that?
Okay, just to maximalize the last few minutes we've got, I'm going to take a group of questions, and then we're going to kind of share them out at the end. So over here, please, and then we'll come down here. If you can pass that, that mic, you're covered. If that mic can go back to the lady over there, thank you.
Okay, thank you. I was so taken with the whole talk again, just like last time I heard about the decolonizing architecture ideas. I wanted you guys to go back briefly to the idea of the birds, because I think that's such an incredible idea that's uncovered there, and one's to do with not just decolonizing the built environment, but also decolonizing the landscape. Rasha, you talked about the idea of olives and of oranges, and I think when we went to Palestine, the idea of olives especially, but of all kinds of fruit and vegetables and the trees and the hills, that is still so much part of the cultural narrative. And I think that whether you go to Bit Sahur or different areas of Palestine or Israel, you see that there's so much of the landscape has been destroyed by this colonization of...
I'm sorry to rush you, but is there a question?
Yes, there is. Yes. Well, basically, I just would like to know some more about this, because I think that's also possibly something else to talk about. There's another form of colonization that's happening. For example, in East Jerusalem and Sheikh Jarrah, there's a lot of outside money that's being brought in to build even more, and that's taking even more from the natural environment. And I was wondering whether possibly Eyal, Sandy, and Alessandro especially would like to respond to this.
But what was the question?
The question is regarding...
We got it? Okay, good. Jean. And then we'll go here, and then that's it.
A question for Rasha Salty. I perfectly understand the point that you make about an axiomatic decision to affirm in the face of the status quo. But I just want to take up this point that you made at the end in relation to something Suleiman said yesterday, which was a decolonized subject is a universal subject. It's an egalitarian universal subject. And I just wondered, because this is not something that's been sort of touched on today, it was touched on in the point that you've just made about cutting through particularity. So I just wondered if you had something to say, because he seemed, when he talked about the aesthetic domain, he reasserted that point that it was the decolonized subject was a universal subject.
Thank you. And we're going to take one more from Merlin.
Thank you for the talk. I guess my question would be, and a lot of my sort of queries about the work were put to rest when I heard, sorry, I've forgotten your name, the lady speak about when she walked around the exhibition, she saw how this work would give people hope. And my question would be, with the military base in Beit Sahur, where you see architecture actually having a direct difference with the, I think it was an American small project to the side of that site, actually something was built there and you see it working. And in this world of paper architecture, if you like, and Schumann says, okay, we'll have questions and then you can all go back to your lives and leave what you learned here. I mean, it's kind of painfully true where you're very much reliant on an audience. If you're not building anything, you're reliant on this momentum that's kept going. And I would argue and I would say that it is a kind of esoteric world within a sort of intellectual world is your audience, and I wouldn't say that it's the average Palestinian person. So if my question, to be precise,
yes,
sorry, is let's say there isn't a peace process in the foreseeable future. Where is decolonizing architecture going to go if it's not having a direct sort of physical impact and it remains within this world of what we're in here?
Okay, great. So we're going to work backwards through the questions, backward through time, and we're going to have to be extremely brief. So perhaps we could start with that, with Merlin's point.
Maybe who'd like to?
Alessandro?
Maybe I can just mention one episode. That when we started, for example, discussing about decolonizing Psagot, we went into a municipality of Elbire, and they had these aerial views, and then there were these two white spots. One is was the settlement, and the other one is the camp. No, these are the two extraterritorial places. So they don't play, they don't see them. They don't see these two places. So
refugee camp,
yes. So let's say if I, because this is a question that we always try, you know, and constantly actually we ask ourselves, no, how we can impact the real world and how we locate our practice. Sometimes we don't want to be trapped just, and you work on that on Ushgrab, that in a way it was the desire of the mayor building a fountain. No, he asked, you know, I want a big fountain, so why you don't do it? No, so you have to ask to try to have an argument why you don't work in this kind of real architecture. At the same time, you don't just want to work on this kind of utopian kind of level, no? That is the solution or the best architecture that you can imagine. I think we managed in a way so far to change in a way to introduce this discourse inside the Palestinian society in different levels. Now, if you go to Elbire, you will find Psagot, you will find the camp. If you, for example, now even the Palestinian authorities start to plan in Area C. So I would not say, never, I would claim, you know, that when we started this project, this were completely a taboo in Palestine. Nobody would even imagine one single project in Area C. Now there are, you know, projects that are planning there. I'm not saying, you know, I don't want to find a kind of linear direction to this, but I think our intervention is exactly in this level of a discourse. And when there will be a different political situation, we don't have to be there. Palestinians will not, I mean, have, they don't need us. I think because of now there is nobody that actually is thinking this project, this is, I think, the right place to be now. But maybe not in the future where everything will be allowed in a way.
Very quickly, please, thank you.
Very quickly.
No,
I don't have very quickly answers, so I would not accept your moderation in this sense. Okay. No, I will try to be very quickly. Actually, I want to return back to how we operate in Israel, not with the universities, because we do not work with Israeli universities. But when we began doing West, when we began thinking about decolonizing architecture in West Bank, we all the time felt at the beginning that we have in somehow find a way to work in Israel, because we are not decolonizing West Bank, we are decolonizing Israel, generally speaking. So the project of the return was absolutely an attempt in this direction, and I will tell a story of why we thought, and I was skeptical at the beginning when we thought we will be working in the camps and in the destroyed villages. I was absolutely the one more skeptical among the three of us, because I worked in the camp for 4 years, and I was thinking that we are really touching a very hard and complex situation, and we can't really deal with it. And I will tell a story of from where really we began. We, Alessandro mentioned the Finik, and we were sitting in with other people from the camp in front of this huge building, built 8-story buildings in the camp, very nice, with guest house, hotel, wedding sala, fitness, and something incredible that is located in the refugee camp. And I was sitting with different ladies, and we were speaking, and at a certain one of the leaders of the camp arrived. His name is Abu Khalil al-Laham. He's very well known as one of the most prominent leaders of refugees. And the ladies were there, and they asked him a very simple question. Abu Khalil, when we are going to return back home? And he says, well, we are maybe still not ready. When we are ready enough, we can return back home.
And one of them says, but we have already bought the bus of return, because there is another institution, very big one, another very big institution, that they even arrived to the point that they bought a bus and they call it the bus of return. And it's there in front of them. And if you go to the Hesha camp, you will see a bus, white one, where it's written the bus of return. So one of them claimed, but we are already ready. We can just like have, you know, 500 transportation to our former villages, and we are ready to return back. So what's the problem? Why you think that we are not ready? And then you can see another lady sitting in the angle, and she was asking the other, but what we are going to do with the Hesha camp? You know, all these stores, culture, buildings that we did, how? And one of them says, but you don't think that we could provide a bus in order to take the Hesha to the former villages, the Hesha refugee camp to our former villages? And this is the real dilemma. This is the real way and the real challenge of how would you think about decolonizing Israel? Because here where we are, and I think, and we are trying our best to answer such challenging, and of course we are working with Zuhrot in this sense to answer you, because I think that they are on the same line where we are. I thought that you are telling me fast that I have to.
He's doing my job for me.
Okay, I finished, but in the same, I would only answer one more question, if you permit me, is about the birds. And I believe, yes, it's very important to think about buildings. But in the same time, I think that what we really suffered a lot, as I mentioned, I'm also heading a department in UNRWA in working on refugee camps. And what I really felt all the time that suffocated me, that each time, and I have money in order to, I'm just like a funder in this sense for the refugees. And one of the things that is frustrating, that whenever you have budget, they want to build. I feel that we as Palestinians, we arrive to the point that we have a kind of, a claustrophobia of building, and we are building everywhere. Everywhere it's just like, you know, building. And I look at where are the public space, but I don't want to use public because it's all the time connected with the space, but where are the void, the empty spaces? When I finally look around, I can look around and feel myself not in an elevator, you know? It's really very important for us to understand. So when you look finally to the map of Palestine, and you look where are these voids, these are exactly the settlements, the Israeli settlements, because all the illegal colonial a process that Israel used was within a kind of legal process inside Israel, which means that you will take over the land when it is a kind of mashah, which means there are different ways of identifying what is not for the private people, and these are our settlements. So if we will not create from now awareness that these are our voids, and if we will not use it, then we will have no voids in the future in Palestine, I think that we will be the losers. And this is very important. And here it's very important to think about birds, to think about nature, and to think about open spaces. And khalas, I know that I am. You would kill me now.
That is halas indeed. Apparently, I've been told it's an absolute definite halas. And I believe that clearly we could go on for a long time. But I fear that we'll be accused of being a dissident group occupying the Tate. And that could bode badly for our friends here who have to head back to Palestine. So with that in mind, please thank the Tate. Let's thank Delfina and our guests this evening for a really wonderful evening. Thank you.